Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am in 2 Kings chapter 16. We're going to look at King Ahaz of Judah, the nastiest, lousiest king of the southern kingdom. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 15 of 2 Kings, we looked at a whole slew of kings, two from Judah and five from Israel, the two from Judah being Azariah, also known as Uzziah, and his son Jotham. And then we looked at some minor kings, Zechariah, Shalom, Menachem. Zechariah was the last king of the dynasty of Jehu. Then we had Shalom, Menachem, these people just assassins, basically. And Pekahiah, and then Pekah, P-E-K-A-H. Could pronounce that Pekah, I guess, but I'm pronouncing Pekah. He is going to show up in the story of Ahaz of Judah. And so we start now with the story of Ahaz, starting in 2 Kings 16, verses 1 through 4. In the 17th year of Pekah, Pekah ruled from 740 to 732, and that date, 732, is a good date to remember, as we'll see here. In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, who ruled from 732 to 716, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, who ruled from 740 to 732, king of Judah, became king. Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and he did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord his God, as his father David had done, and that is an understatement. But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, that would be the golden calf worship, illegitimate, illegal form of the worship of the true God Yahweh, and he even made, Ahab did, even made his son pass through the fire, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had driven out from before the sons of Israel, i.e. the Canaanites. He sacrificed and burned incense on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. Now it says in the 17th year of Pekah, there are lots of difficulties with that number, as the Cambridge pulpit commentaries say and as Colindale say, and I am not competent to resolve those numbers, though that number at least, so I'm going to leave that to anybody who aspires to be a PhD in biblical studies. Now, Pekah dies in 732. That's the northern kingdom's king in 732, and that's the same year that Ahaz starts ruling in the south, 732. Now, this time frame is the period when Isaiah, the famous prophet Isaiah, is prophesying. He prophesied between Uzziah, 767, and Hezekiah, who died in 687. So you're talking about 100 years or so in there. Well, less than 100 years. That span of reigns was 100 years, and somewhere in that 100 years, Isaiah was prophesying. And Isaiah was in that period, too. He was from 732 to 716. So that's our general time frame. I said earlier, he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. That's the golden calf worship, the Jeroboam son of Nebat set up 910 B.C. when he took over, put one golden calf up in the north at Dan and one golden calf in the south at Bethel. Well, all the northern kings of Israel did that, but Ahaz, he's the southern king now, Ahaz, he not only tolerated golden calf worship, but he did worse than that. He made his sons pass through the fire. Now, a lot of these pagan gods had child sacrifice, and many people think that's what this means. He made his sons pass through the fire. Now, some people don't believe that. They believe passing through the fire means this. There are two fires on each side of the idol, and then you dedicate your son to the idol by passing the son through the fire on each side, not actually burning the son up, but just pushing him through the middle of the two fires and then pulling him back out. One argument in favor of this is that if Ahaz put his son, passed his son through the fire and killed him, well, how did Hezekiah live to tell about it, because Ahaz's son Hezekiah takes over the throne? Well, the answer to this is that actually more than one of Ahaz's sons passed through the fire. We read in 2 Chronicles 28:3, moreover, Ahaz burned incense in the valley of Ben-Hinnom and burned his sons, plural, in fire. Burned his sons, plural, in fire. So even if Ahaz managed to burn some sons in the fire, he had another son, Hezekiah, who lived to tell about it. Now, most people think that passing through the fire means to burn up the son as a sacrifice to the idol. Now, here's some scripture supporting that view. Psalms 106, verse 38. And shed innocent blood, the blood of their sons and their daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan. the blood of their sons and daughters whom they sacrifice. That sounds like child sacrifice. Jeremiah 7:31, they have built the high places of Topheth, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I did not command, and it did not come into my mind. Sounds like they built altars in the trash dump, that valley of Hinnom, to the south of the city of David, the south of Zion, Mount Zion, and they actually burnt their sons and their daughters in the fire. Sounds like child sacrifice to me. Ezekiel 23:37-39. For they have committed adultery, and blood is on their hands. Thus they have committed adultery with their idols, and even caused their sons, whom they bore to me, to pass through to fire to them as food. Sounds like child sacrifice to me. Reading on in Ezekiel 23:38 again, they have done this to me. They have defiled my sanctuary on the same day and have profaned my Sabbaths. For when they had slaughtered their children for their idols, sounds like child sacrifice to me, they entered my sanctuary. So we're going to assume that Ahab actually burnt more than one of his sons in a fire to sacrifice to his abominable idols. Some people, if we're looking for other options, is what it means to pass through the fire. Some people say it's human semen offered in the fire. That's a good one. Adam Clark says that, he mentions that, this passing through the fire means just to singe or to scorch the son, but not to burn him whole. Well, I think as we look through all those options, I think that we are going to think the worst of Ahab, that he burnt his sons to idols. Makes a better story anyway. Verse 4, he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. Now, none of the kings of Judah had ever done that before. These high places are mentioned with every king. And those kings allowed the people to sacrifice there, and usually it was sacrificed to Yahweh and not to an idol. But here, Ahaz went up to the high places himself to sacrifice. He not only failed to tear them down, he went up to the high places himself. And we can probably assume he was not sacrificing to Yahweh on those high places. He was sacrificing to whatever nasty idol he wanted to sacrifice to. I'm not sure what his idols were. Baal, Astarte, whoever. We go now to 2 Kings 16:5-6. Then Rezin, that's the Syrian king, and he ruled from 780-732, king of Aram, Syria. And Pekah, who ruled from 740-732, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war. So we see that Rezin died in 732. Pekah died in 732. There's a reason for that. It's because Tiglath-Pileser III, as we'll see, comes up to northern Israel and whops Pekah, and he also killed Rezin in Damascus. So that's why they died on the same year. And then, of course, now it's just, I guess it's just coincidental that Ahaz starts ruling in the same year, 732. So this alliance between Pekah and Rezin we're going to be talking about for the rest of this chapter. Remember, Pekah is the northern king. Rezin is the Syrian king. They are close together. They spent most of their careers, most of their histories, I should say, fighting each other. But now they're going to be allied with each other to come after Judah, southern Israel, whose king was Ahaz. So they besieged Ahaz, but could not overcome him at that time. Rezin, king of Aram, recovered Eilat for Aram and cleared the Judeans out of Eilat entirely, and the Arameans came to Eilat and have lived there to this day. Now, there's a lot of fighting going on here, and it's difficult to make out the chronology. Ellicott says it is perhaps impossible to weave the various data of Isaiah, Kings, and Chronicles into a single narrative which shall be free from all objection. But Ellicott suggests a chronology which I suppose is as good as any, so we'll use him. First of all, Ahaz gets whipped by Pekah and Rezin, Pekah of the northern kingdom of Israel and Rezin of Samaria. 2 Chronicles 28:5, so the Lord his God handed Ahaz over to the king of Aram. That would be Rezin. Rezin attacked Ahaz and took many captives to Damascus, Damascus being the capital of Syria, where Rezin ruled. Ahaz was also handed over to the king of Israel, that's Pekah, who struck him with great force. All right, so Ahaz is getting clobbered by the Syrians and the northern Israelites. Pekah and Rezin are marching upon Jerusalem after they have beaten Ahaz. It doesn't say where they beat Ahaz, but it doesn't matter. The point is they are heading for Jerusalem. Ahaz realizes he's in trouble, so he sends messengers. He sends envoys to Tiglath-Pileser III in Assyria. Now, Tiglath-Pileser III was one of the greatest world-conquering heroes, military heroes there ever was. He ranks up there with Alexander the Great, Augustus Caesar. And Ahaz is between the rock and the hard place, so he goes to this big, bad Assyrian king, Tiglath-Pileser, for help. Meanwhile, Pekah and Rezin, still whipping up on the southern Judahites, they realize they can't beat Jerusalem with a siege. Jerusalem's walled, it's on a hill, it's too hard to get. So Pekah continues to ravage Israel, and meanwhile Rezin goes down the eastern side of the Arab Valley, the Transjordan area, keeps on going. Let's just say that Rezin crosses the Jordan River north of the Dead Sea. He ends up in the tribe of Gad, then he goes south of Gad and ends up in Reuben, then he goes south of the Arnon River, he's in Moab, but he's all to the east. That's to the east of Israel, east of Judah. Judah has no power or control or land on the eastern side of the Dead Sea, and so Rezin keeps going south, all the way south through Edom, down to the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, where Eilat is, and he captures it. Meanwhile, Tiglath-Pileser decides he is going to help Ahab out, and he's going to attack Rezin and Pekah. And so he does so, killing both of them, beating them both and killing them. That's a reasonable chronology. Now, what was the purpose that Pekah besieged Ahaz? They were going to try to set up another king in the southern kingdom. Pekah was going to try to do that. Rezin was his ally. But Pekah's purpose was to set up another king down there, Isaiah 7, 5 through 6. Because Aram with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah has planned evil against you, Isaiah says, against you, Ahaz, saying, let us go up against Judah and terrorize it and make for ourselves a breach in its walls and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it. So they were going to make Judah a tributary kingdom. They were going to wipe it out, basically. Maybe not wipe it out, but subjugate it. But they failed to do that, because it says in 2 Kings 16, verse 5, they could not overcome Ahaz. They were scorching the earth, but they couldn't capture Jerusalem and couldn't set up a puppet king. So they didn't overcome him at that time, but at other times they had gotten great advantage over Ahaz. They had killed many of the southern Judahites, and they had carried many of the southern Judahites as captive and made them slaves. We read in 2 Chronicles 28, 5 through 8, wherefore the Lord his God delivered him, that's Ahaz, into the hand of the king of Aram, that's Rezin, and they defeated him. Rezin and Pekah defeated Ahaz and carried away from him a great number of captives and brought them to Damascus. And he was also delivered, Ahaz was also delivered into the hand of the king of Israel, into Pekah's hand, who inflicted Ahaz with heavy casualties, for Pekah the son of Remaliah slew in Judah 120,000 in one day, all valiant men, because they had forsaken the Lord God of their fathers. And Zichri, a mighty man of Ephraim, that's the northern kingdom, and Zichri slew Maaseiah the king's son, that's Ahaz's son, and Azrikam, the ruler of the house, that means the palace, and Elkanah, the second to the king. These are some of Ahaz's government officials, as well as another one of his sons. It was rough being a son in the house of Ahaz. If Ahaz didn't put you on an altar and fry you, then you're going to get beat by the oppressors of Israel. Verse 8, 2 Chronicles 28. The sons of Israel carried away captive of their brethren, that's the Judahites, 200,000 women, sons and daughters, and they took also a great deal of spoil from them and brought the spoil to Samaria. So you see, Pekah and Rezin were doing a number on Ahaz. Ahaz was in a bad, bad situation. Now, it's likely at this time that Isaiah was sent to console Ahaz, and then he predicted the death of both Pekah and Rezin. We read in Isaiah 7:1, now it came about in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not conquer it. And so then we see, if we keep reading in Isaiah, which I won't do, Isaiah has been sent to Ahaz because of this invasion from the north. Now, there's an incidental detail mentioned in 2 Kings 16, verse 6. At that time, Rezin, king of Aram, recovered Eilat. Now, Eilat is the town that's on the north tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, which is the gulf that is to the eastern edge of the Sinai Peninsula. On the western edge is the Suez Gulf, and both of those gulfs attached to the Red Sea. I like to talk about Eilat because I spent a night there with my wife on a trip, and it also turns out it has a lot of history in the Old Testament. it was a port that allowed ships harboring there to go south out of the Red Sea, around the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, and to India. So it was important for trade. Now, as it turns out, this little parenthetical verse 6 has actually got a lot of complicated stuff in it, so I'm going to spend some time on a point that's relatively unimportant, but just for the sake of thoroughness, we'll do it. First of all, it says in verse 6, reason recovered Eilat for Aram. That means that Syria at some time must have owned Eilat before reason recovered it for Syria. At least it sounds like that. Well, I'm going to give you a suggested timeline, and we're going to have to speculate as to when Syria held Eilat in order and then lost Eilat in order for them to recover it under reason. So here's a summary of Eilat's history. This is from John Gill. First of all, Edom owned it, of course, because Eilat's down there in Edom, southern Edom. Then David took Eilat back from Edom. And then, of course, Solomon used it for trading. Ships from Hiram he combined with. And then Edom took Eilat back from Judah under the southern king Jehoram, who ruled from 848 to 841. We read that in 2 Kings 8:20. During Jehoram's reign, Edom rebelled against Judah's control and appointed their own king. So since Eilat's in Edom, we assume that Eilat is lost to Israel under Jehoram. And then now we speculate. Maybe Amaziah, who ruled 796 to 767, took it back from Edom. And then we speculated again that maybe when they took it back from Edom, Eilat, that Syria had taken Eilat away from the Edomites before. Now, here's the logic of that. Amaziah's successor, Uzziah, restored Eilat to Judah, 2 Kings 14:22. Uzziah rebuilt Eilat and restored it to Judah after Amaziah the king rested with his fathers. Well, if he's restoring it to Judah, that means Amaziah must have lost it. His father must have lost it, and Uzziah the son got it back for Amaziah. But we have to assume somewhere in there that Syria took it away from Edom, and so in order for them to have lost it once, so that it could be said to be recovered here in our verse 6, recovered by reason. Well, that's complicated, and that's very speculative. Here's the best option to explain this word recovered. There's a couple of options, a couple of ways you can explain this. Well, there's one way you can explain it, is that the Syrians actually never held Eilat before. This is the first time under reason. And there's two ways that you can try to prove that the Syrians had never held Eilat before. First of all, recovered can be translated differently. So instead of saying reason recovered Eilat, we can translate it as God's Word translation does. At that time, King Reason of Aram drove the Judeans out of Eilat. So he's not recovering it for Syria, he's just driving the Judeans out. But an even better way to show that the Syrians had never held Eilat before is to translate the verse this way. At that time, Rezin, king of Aram, recovered Eilat for Edom, not for Aram. That, of course, is a translation issue. I'm going to talk about that translation issue in a minute. We can see this very good textual authority that the recovery that Rezin did was not for himself, not for his own kingdom, but was for the kingdom of Edom. The Septuagint, in fact, actually has Edom. King Rezin recovered Eilat for Edom, not Syria. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that most judicious commentators prefer Edom to Aram. So Rezin recovered it for Edom, not for his own country of Syria. Ellicott says the words for Syria and Edom, Syrians and Edomites, are very much alike in Hebrew writing and the Hebrew margin. Many manuscripts, the Septuagint, the Vulgate, read Edomites for Syrians. Well, if that's true, if that's correct, then Rezin emancipated the Edomites from the yoke that Uzziah had imposed upon the Edomites. And that would also explain why verse 6 is even there, to show that the southern kingdom is getting whomped. In fact, verse 6 says that Rezin cleared the Judeans out of Eilat entirely, and the Arameans or the Edomites came to Eilat and live there to this day. It doesn't matter who lived there or who Eilat was recovered for. The point is that Eilat, a very important trading place, has been lost to the wicked king Ahaz of Judah. And by the way, Ezion Geber is mentioned a lot of times, which is so close to Eilat, they don't know exactly where it is, but it's right there in the same general area. So sometimes you'll hear Ezion Geber instead of Eilat. We go down to 2 Kings 16, verses 7 through 9. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, and that's Tiglath-Pileser III, who ruled from 745 to 727, king of Assyria, saying, "I am your servant and your son," says Ahaz. "Come up and deliver me, Tiglath-Pileser III. Deliver me from the hand of the king of Aram, Rezin, and from the hand of the king of Israel, Pekah, who are rising up against me." Ahaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house, and sent a present to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria listened to him. And the king of Assyria went up against Damascus, that's the capital of Syria, where Rezin ruled. And Tiglath-Pileser III went up against Rezin and captured it, captured Damascus, and carried the people of Damascus away into exile to Kir, that's K-I-R, and put Rezin to death. That's 732, bye-bye Rezin. Tiglath-Pileser III, by the way, in a previous chapter, in the text of 2 Kings, calls him Pul, P-U-L, but he's more known in ancient history as Tiglath-Pileser III, so that's what we're going to call him. The text here actually calls him Tiglath-Pileser. Ahaz says, "Tiglath-Pileser, I am your servant and your son." In other words, I want to be a vassal to you. I submit myself to you. You're the big dog. I am a bootlicking lackey of yours. He's in trouble. "Come up and deliver me from the king of Aram, from Rezin, and from the Pekah of Israel." Now, I was saying that Ahaz was in deep doo-doo, and that's why he sought this alliance with Tiglath-Pileser III. But actually, Ahab had no reason to seek help from Tiglath-Pileser III because God had promised Ahaz deliverance from those two kings. We read that in Isaiah 7, 4 through 8. And God is speaking to Isaiah, "Say to Ahaz, take care and be calm. Have no fear and do not be faint-hearted because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands." That's Pekah and Rezin that are called two stubs of smoldering firebrands. "On account of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram, the son of Remaliah, and the son of Remaliah. Because Aram with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah," remember the son of Remaliah is Pekah, king of northern Israel, king of Ephraim, "because Aram with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah has planned evil against you, saying, 'Let us go up against Judah and terrorize it and make for ourselves a breach in its walls and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it.' Thus says the Lord God, 'It shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. For the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Now within another 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered so that it is no longer a people.'" So Isaiah had given Ahaz plenty of hope, but of course Ahaz doesn't believe in God. And so he leans on the arm of the flesh, Tiglath-Pileser III. He's going to be sorry for this. To induce Tiglath-Pileser III to come help him out, Ahaz took the silver and gold that were in two places, the house of the Lord, that's the temple, and in the king's house, that's the king's palace where he lived. We recall in 1 Kings, I think it was, where we went through all the detailed construction of the Temple of Solomon and the Palace of Solomon and how glorious and awesome it was. Lots of silver, lots of gold. Well, Ahaz took what was left of the gold and sent it up to Tiglath-Pileser III. Now, the only silver and gold that was there was the gold that Uzziah and Jotham had put there. Because during the times of Amaziah, and Amaziah ruled from 796 to 767, Amaziah had that big famous battle with Jehoash, Amaziah being the little thistle, Jehoash being the cedar of Lebanon, remember, and Jehoash beat the ever-loving mud out of Amaziah and actually took him captive. And we read in 2 Kings 14:14, he, that's Jehoash of Israel, took all the gold and silver and all the utensils which were found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house, the hostages also, and returned to Samaria. So that means that Amaziah, having lost all the gold and silver in the temple and the palace, that gold and silver had to be built up again by Uzziah, who reigned from 767 to 740, and Jotham, Uzziah's son, 740 to 732. So there's been about 35 years of collecting gold and silver, but now it's all gone because Ahaz takes it and tries to buy off Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser III. Now, this is what Ahaz got in return for all that silver and gold. Tiglath-Pileser III did not help Ahaz fight against the Philistines. Tiglath-Pileser III did not lend Judah any troops to help to fight northern Israel. Now, it is true he did wipe out Syria and Pekah, killed them. So I guess that was of some help. Now, let's take a little peek. I've already mentioned this once, but let's do it again. Let's go to 2 Chronicles 28, verses 8 through 16, and look at how bad off Ahaz was when he went to Tiglath-Pileser III. Verse 16 says, At that time, King Ahaz sent to the kings of Assyria for help. Well, let's see what motivated him to do so. 2 Chronicles 28, verses 8 through 16. The sons of Israel carried away captive of their brethren 200,000 women, sons and daughters, and they took also a great deal of spoil from them, but brought the spoil to Samaria. But a prophet of the Lord was there, whose name was Oded, and he went out to meet the army which came to Samaria, and said to them, Behold, because the Lord, the God of your fathers, was angry with Judah, he has delivered them into your hand, and you have slain them in a rage which has even reached heaven. Now you are proposing to subjugate for yourselves the people of Judah and Jerusalem for male and female slaves? Surely do you not have transgressions of your own against the Lord your God? Now this is spoken concerning the northern Israelites, the Ephraimites, in Samaria, their capital, concerning the great victories that Pekah of Israel had over Ahaz of Judah, all the captive women, the sons, the daughters, and so forth. And the people of Ephraim, the people of northern Israel, were contemplating making the people of Judah their slaves. And so this is when Oded the prophet comes up and he says, Hey, you think they sinned? Yeah, they got beat. The Judahites got beat because of their sins, but your sins, you got them too. And Oded continues, verse 11, Now therefore listen to me and return the captives whom you captured from your brothers, from your brother Judahites. For the burning anger of the Lord is against you. Notice they're still brothers, even though they're beating each other's brains out and killing each other. They're still Hebrews. The burning anger of the Lord is against you. Then some of the heads of the sons of Ephraim, I'm not going to mention their names, arose against those who were coming from the battle, the soldiers, and said to them, You must not bring the captives from Judah in here, for you are proposing to bring upon us guilt against the Lord, adding to our sins and our guilt, for our guilt is great, so that his burning anger is against Israel. So the armed men left the captives and the spoil before the officers and all the assembly. Then the men who were designated by name arose, took the captives, and they clothed all their naked ones from the spoil. And they gave them clothes and sandals, fed them and gave them drink, anointed them with oil, led all their feeble ones on donkeys, and brought them to Jericho, the city of palm trees, to their brothers. Then they returned to Samaria. At that time, King Ahaz sent to the kings of Assyria for help. So Ahaz had just gotten all of his people back after his armies had been defeated, and that's when he went to Tiglath-Pileser for help. And Tiglath-Pileser, in response, goes to Damascus, captures Damascus, kills Rezin, and sends the people of Damascus to a place called Kir. They were exiled to Kir. That's K-I-R. Now, where is Kir? Nobody seems to know. One commentator I had said it was a place in Upper Media. That's northern Iran today, northern Persia. BibleAtlas.org seems to say that nobody knows exactly what is intended. The word means a wall or a fortress. So wherever it was, I'm going to assume northern Iran, because that's fairly close, just to the east of Syria. But they were put into exile. And the interesting thing about this exile, it was prophesied by the prophet Amos, who prophesied the early part of the same century, early 700s. We're now in 732 or so. Amos 1:5, I will break, this is God speaking, I will also break the gate bar of Damascus, so the people of Aram will go exile to Kir, says the Lord. Ah, the people of Damascus to go exile to Kir. He prophesied the actual place that they were going to be exiled to. Amos also prophesied that Rezin was going to die. We see in that same verse, Amos 1:5, I just read you a skinny version of Amos 1:5, let me read you the full verse. I will break down the gates of Damascus. I will cut off the ruler. Cut off means to kill. I will cut off the ruler. That's Rezin. I will cut off the ruler from the valley of Avon, the valley of idols. And the one who wields the scepter, I'm going to cut off the one who wields the scepter. That's the ruler. The scepter is the symbol of rulership. I'm going to cut him off from Beth Eden, the house of pleasure. Those are symbolic, I think. the Valley of Idols, the House of Pleasure. That's the description of Damascus. And Rezin is going to get cut off from there because he's going to get killed. Interesting prophecy. We go to 2 Kings 16, verses 10 through 14. Now King Ahaz, remember he ruled from 732 to 716. Now King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. This is after Rezin has been bumped off by Tiglath-Pileser. Ahaz goes up there to see his benefactor. Ahaz saw the altar which was at Damascus, and of course this was a pagan altar. And King Ahaz sent to Uriah the priest the pattern of the altar and its model, according to all its workmanship. That's Uriah is a southern, he's a priest in Judah, a Yahweh priest. Verse 11, so Uriah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. Thus Uriah the priest made it before the coming of King Ahaz from Damascus. When the king came from Damascus, the king saw the altar. Then the king approached the altar and went up to it and burned his burnt offering and his meal offering and poured his drink offering and sprinkled the blood of his peace offerings on the altar. The bronze altar which was before the Lord he brought from the front of the house, from between his altar and the house of the Lord, and he put it on the north side of his altar. So Ahaz is going to do a little remodeling of the temple. He saw this big altar up in Damascus. He says, I'd like to have that altar. So he gets some blueprints up. Well, they actually made a model. Sent the specs on down to Jerusalem and said, Uriah, make me a temple. Make me an altar, not a temple, but an altar. Now, Ahaz probably, when he saw that altar in Damascus, he probably offered a sacrifice on it with Tiglath-Pileser III, his good buddy. As we see now, Ahaz is completely apostate. Now, this Uriah is probably the high priest. It says the priest, but he's probably the high priest. He seems to be a priest that Isaiah took to be a witness in Isaiah 8:2. And I will take to myself, this is God speaking, and I, Yahweh, will take to myself faithful witnesses for testimony. Uriah the priest. Well, if that's so, Uriah has degenerated from being a faithful witness for Yahweh to being a constructor of a pagan altar. The altar was built before Ahaz even managed to get back from Damascus. Ahaz was hot to get that altar built, and so Uriah built it quickly. He sent the directions for the altar before Ahaz had even left Damascus. And the priest must have worked very fast, Uriah must have worked very fast to get the altar built before Ahaz got back home to Samaria. Now in verse 13, we see that Ahaz on this pagan altar burnt his burnt offering, his meal offering, his drink offering, and the blood of all of the typical offerings that are done in Levitical worship, legal Yahweh worship. He just adapted it and used the Levitical methods to sacrifice to his pagan god. As John Gill says, we should note how Levitical sacrifices were imitated by the pagans. That could be, or it could be that instinctively all humans want to sacrifice that way with blood, with incense. I don't know. But at any rate, it's just amazing how the things of God get adulterated, get compromised with syncretism. People just love to downgrade, to walk away from the proper ways of worshiping God. And if you don't believe me, look at the woke church here in America. Now, verse 14, we see the bronze altar. That's the famous bronze altar, the altar of burnt offering. The altar of burnt offering is sometimes called the bronze altar, which is in front of the temple in the courtyard where all the sacrifices were done, all the animal sacrifices. This one had been made by Solomon, 2 Chronicles 4:1. Then he made a bronze altar 20 cubits in length. That's 30 feet. And 20 cubits in width. That's 30 feet. And 10 cubits in height. That's 15 feet high. 30 by 30 by 15, that's big. That's a big old altar. And the one from Altar we'll see is called the altar from Damascus, or the altar that was built on the pattern of the altar in Damascus is called the Great Altar. So the phony pagan idolatrous offer was even bigger than that, bigger than the bronze altar. And Ahab pushed the legal altar, the bronze altar, he put it in an out-of-the-way place. He put his great pagan altar right in front of the temple, and then he, to the right as you face the temple, remember the doorway of the temple faces east, so if you're facing into that doorway, facing towards the altar of burnt offering, the north side of that altar is to the right, and so he just basically pushed the bronze altar out to the right and left his big, fancy pagan altar right there in front in the temple courtyard. Now, the way this thing worked was, when the new altar was built, he built the new great altar Uriah did and put it in front of the bronze altar to the east of the bronze altar. So the bronze altar is overshadowed and kind of hidden already. And then to put it even more out of the way, he moved it from in between the temple and the new altar. The bronze altar was situated in between the front door of the temple and the bronze altar. And so then Ahaz had it moved away from that place between the temple and the new pagan altar. He moved it from there to the side, to the north, so it was completely out of the way. So we go down to 2 Kings 16, verses 15 through 16. Then King Ahaz commanded Uriah the priest, offer on the great altar, the great altar, that's the pagan one, the copy of the altar in Damascus. Offer, O the great altar, the morning burnt offering, the evening grain offering, and the king's burnt offering and his grain offerings. All those were legitimate offerings prescribed in Leviticus, but now they're going to be offered on a pagan altar. Ahaz continues telling Uriah, also offer the burnt offering of all the people of the land, their grain offering and their drink offering. Sprinkle on the altar, on this new pagan altar, all the blood of the burnt offering and all the blood of sacrifice. Okay, so all that's just normal legal sacrifices done on a pagan altar. And then Ahaz says, the bronze altar will be for me to seek guidance, which is kind of strange because the bronze altar is not the great altar. The bronze altar is the legal Yahweh altar, which has been set aside to the north, but it's still going to be used. Ahaz is going to be going to use it to seek guidance. Uriah the priest did everything King Ahaz commanded. Now in verse 15, the pagan altar is called the great altar. That word there probably indicates that Ahaz thought he could make his altar bigger and thus better than God's altar. I wouldn't doubt it. Now, why did he keep the bronze altar to seek guidance? Well, first of all, it might be that's not what it means. John Gill says that the text means here that Ahaz was to search, to inquire, to consider what was to be done with the altar. The bronze altar will be over here for me to seek guidance as to what to do with this thing. It's in the way. Gill uses, to back that argument up, the statement that altars were never used as oracles. The bronze altar will be used for me to seek guidance. It sounds like Ahaz is actually using the altar to seek guidance, which is our other way of interpreting this. But John Gill says that Ahaz wants to dispose of the bronze altar as God would have him to do it, or as the pagan god that he was praying to would have him to do it. I don't think that's what it means. I think he's actually going to use that altar to seek guidance, to make special requests to God. Now, why would Ahaz do that? Why couldn't he just inquire about the will of God using his fancy new pagan altar? Well, there's some reasons why he couldn't demolish the bronze altar. One reason is a political reason. He could have feared the people. Matthew Henry suggests this. He says that Ahaz pretends to advance the use of the bronze altar for political reasons. I had another idea. Maybe he's just hedging his bets. He's saying, well, you know, I'm getting rid of Yahweh's altar, but Yahweh might be mad at me for doing that, so maybe I better keep him around too. He was one confused son of a gun, Ahaz was. We go now to 2 Kings 16, 17 through 20, and we will finish this audio. Then King Ahaz cut off the frames of the water carts and removed the bronze basin from each of them. He took the reservoir from the bronze oxen that were under it and put it on a stone pavement. To satisfy the king of Assyria, Ahaz removed from the Lord's temple the Sabbath canopy they had built in the palace, and he closed the outer entrance for the king. The rest of the events of Ahaz's reigns, along with his accomplishments, are written in the historical record of Judah's kings. Ahaz rested with his fathers and was buried, that's in 716 B.C., and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, and his son Hezekiah became king in his place. Now, what we see here in these verses is Ahaz needs bronze because he's given all of his gold and silver to Tiglath-Pileser III, and he's got to replace the gold and silver utensils, for example, and some other things too. He's got to have bronze to replace all that, so this is where he gets it. The frames of the water carts, that's the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. Those are the, I've got a picture here, they're little carts, and there's a, it's kind of like a wagon, a little child's wagon with four wheels. And the sides of the wagon is a perfect square. That's the frames that Ahaz cut off to get the bronze. And then in that little wagon, there's a round basin that water was held, put in. And these, I forgot how many of them, 20, I forgot. They're scattered, they're placed all around the sides of the of Solomon's temple. So Ahaz cut off all the frames, and he took the reservoir, which is a terrible translation in my humble opinion of the Holman Christian Study Bible, but that's called the bronze sea, the laver in some places, that big, round, flat basin that held a lot of water that the priest washed in. There were four bronze oxen that held it up. Well, that's bronze. Ahaz needed bronze, so he cut the bronze out from under the reservoir. He had to put it somewhere, put it on a stone pavement. Now, that's not upon the floor of the temple, as Gil says, for the floor of the temple was of wood, fir or cedar, some kind of wood. Well, of course, the bronze altar is in the courtyard. I don't know why Gil says that. It's in the courtyard, not in the temple itself. Courtyard, I assume, was made out of dirt. But maybe not. Maybe the courtyard was not made out of dirt. This is a palace. But whatever the flooring was, Ahaz put rows of stone down there on the floor and then put the bronze sea on top of those rows of stone. Again, he needed those bronze oxen for other purposes, maybe to make other idols, maybe for utensils. Now in verse 18, there's a Sabbath canopy that's removed. There are some speculations as to what this canopy was. It's obviously used on the Sabbath day. Option number one, it was a canopy under which the people used to sit in order to hear the law explained by the priest. Option number two, it was for a place for the course of priests to stay in as they come in to serve their time in the temple. The priests and the Levites would come in once every 2 weeks or so. And so they would come in, shelter under this canopy, wait for the priests to leave that were there. The priests that would leave would come in, come out and shelter under the canopy. Then the priests that were coming in, they would leave the canopy and go to their stations. And so it was just a place so that there could be a transfer of priestly duties. That was option number two. Option number three, the Sabbath canopy could be a place for the king himself to sit under while attending the temple service of that day. Well, whatever it was removed. And it was removed, obviously, to satisfy Tiglath-Pileser III, to signify to Tiglath-Pileser III that Ahaz would not frequent that place anymore, the Sabbath canopy. Now, why would Tiglath-Pileser III even care about that? Well, it would show more humility on Ahaz's part if he says, I'm not going to be messing around here with Yahweh anymore. I now worship the gods of Damascus and Syria. Tiglath-Pileser III would probably think that for Ahaz to worship foreign gods that are not the gods of his own location, then that's not a very dangerous situation for Tiglath-Pileser III, because Ahaz is so weak he can't even rely on his own territorial gods. Well, that's one reason, maybe, that the Sabbath canopy was removed to show that Ahaz was finished with Yahweh. There's a couple of other possible reasons. John Gill suggests that the canopy was removed so that Tiglath-Pileser III could not see his way into the temple. Remember this canopy. Well, if you assume that the canopy is a canopy that covers the way, the route between the king's palace and the temple, if somebody not being familiar with the palace and temple looked up and saw that thing, they'd say, well, that thing goes somewhere. I wonder where it goes to. And you walk down the pathway under the canopy, and lo and behold, you're in the temple. And once you're in the temple, you can see all the gold and silver in there. So this is what Gill says. The Sabbath canopy was, quote, a sort of covert way that the kings of Judah had to the temple. And Ahaz had it removed, lest the king of Assyria, going by that way and seeing the sacred vessels, should covet them. If that way had been open, he might have gone by it into the temple and have seen the sacred vessels, and so have asked them from a man who was in no condition to refuse them. How unwilling he might be to give them up. In other words, Tiglath-Pileser is going to see the Sabbath canopy. He's going to say, oh, this is pretty. Walk down it. Oh, this takes me into the temple. And once I get into the temple, whoa, golden candlesticks, golden utensils everywhere, golden altar of incense. Ooh, I like gold. I want them. That actually makes a lot of sense to me. Another reason may be that the Sabbath canopy was removed is Ahaz might think, one day I'm going to have to hide from Tiglath-Pileser III if he comes down here wanting to kill me. So I'll hide in the temple, and this Sabbath canopy is just pointing its way right to the temple, and I don't want to get caught. That could be. We finish up the chapter in verse 20. Ahaz rested with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. Ah, in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the kings. We go to 2 Chronicles 28:27. So Ahaz slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city in Jerusalem, for they did not bring him into the tombs of the kings of Israel. Why was that? Well, because he was such a jerk. I remember Uzziah having contracted leprosy for ministering in the temple when he had no right to. He was buried in a field outside the kings of Israel. And there was another king. I'm trying to think of some other kings who were buried outside of the tombs of the kings of Israel. But the idea is, if the king is a real jerk, they don't want to honor him, so they bury him somewhere in a non-royal tomb. Now, they don't just throw him into the pauper's grave or leave him out on the street so the birds can get him. After all, he was a king of Israel. But they don't put him into the king's tomb. And so now we see that Ahaz was one of the worst kings of Judah, but he had one of the best prophets of Judah, Isaiah, to minister to him. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we are finished with 2 Kings chapter 16, verses 1 through 20. And we're now prepared to go to 2 Kings, the next chapter, chapter 17, 1 through 23. And we will look at the last king of Israel, Hoshea, and the fall of Israel to Assyria. I hope you stay tuned for that momentous event, and I hope you enjoy this audio.